This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 14th, 2007. Filling in for Aldo Bogado, I'm Mitch Jezrich at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. The American Bar Association calls for President Bush's recent executive order on the treatment of detainees to be overturned.
The ABA cannot countenance the continued violation of international law, which has already done incalculable damage to our nation at home and abroad.
A new report shows that half of all low-income people who go to bed hungry in the United States don't receive food stamps. And Somalia's interim government and rebel fighters deny human rights abuses alleged in a new report. Coming up, we'll talk with one of the report's authors. We'll have all this and more after these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Massive flooding in North Korea has killed hundreds of people, damaged numerous buildings, and inundated tens of thousands of acres of farmland. North Korean state-run media has reported major damage to the country's communications, electrical, mining, and transportation infrastructure. The usually reclusive government of North Korea has already requested assistance from the United Nations World Food Program. The disaster in North Korea comes on the heels of devastating floods across South Asia. U.S. soldiers and Iraqi security forces have launched a major new offensive in the restive Iraqi province of Diyala. Hiba Dawood has this report.
Baquba is the capital of the Iraqi province of Diyala and is a mixed city of Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. As part of a new offensive dubbed Operation Lightning Hammer, Iraqi security forces are reportedly attempting to root out members and supporters of Al-Qaeda, the Mehdi Army, and other insurgent groups. The operation began overnight with an airstrike and involves more than 15,000 U.S. and Iraqi troops. Local residents have come out to demonstrate against the operation, saying it will only force people to evacuate the city. Iraq Islamic Party member Ala Mekki says that new recruiting efforts are underway to combat infiltration within the ranks of the Diyala security forces.
People of Diyala are being recruited to fight Al-Qaeda and the Mehdi Army. The leadership of the Iraqi forces in Baquba has changed. We brought in people who are impartial and more competent.
The operation in Baquba comes in the context of a larger offensive called Operation Phantom Strike. The renewed push to secure the countryside around Baghdad comes 1 month before a progress report must be delivered to the U.S. Congress to secure further funding for the war. For FSRN, I'm Hiba Dawood.
The Israeli army killed at least five Palestinians today during an incursion into southern Gaza. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
Medical sources reported that five Palestinians were killed and 32 others wounded, including five critically, after the Israeli army invaded the southern Gaza Strip early this morning. According to local eyewitnesses, Israeli tanks and armored vehicles, backed by warplanes and the drones, opened fire on houses and razed vast areas of arable land. Scores of residents were also arrested during the attack. Safa Al-Ibrahim, a resident of Khan Yunis, describes what she saw.
Up to this moment, the Israeli forces still open heavy random fire at our houses, terrifying our children. What we need now is to stop the Israeli military operation and to live safely at least.
Israeli media sources said the aim of today's attack was to prevent attempts to smuggle weapons along the eastern Gaza-Israel border line. Hamas, who lost two of its men in the attack, vowed to avenge the killings. The Islamist movement has been suffering from a strict international boycott since it took over Gaza in June. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Almighari in southern Gaza.
Yet another Guatemalan politician has been murdered in the run-up to the country's general elections. Unidentified gunmen armed with assault rifles shot and killed Werner Velasquez Monday afternoon as he left the residence of a candidate running in local elections. Velasquez was the mayor of Santa Ana Huista, a Guatemalan town near the border with Mexico. Although he was not running for re-election, he is the latest in more than 40 assassinations of Guatemalan politicians and political operatives this election season. The governor of Nevada has announced that Mexico is considering a program to pay for the health care costs incurred by Mexican nationals living in Nevada. A similar program called Windows of Health is already being tested in New York. The program would be available to all Mexicans who register with a consulate in Las Vegas, regardless of immigration status. Governor Jim Gibbons is currently in Mexico, where he has met with the secretaries of Health and Education and with law enforcement officials. And finally, toymaker Mattel Incorporated is recalling millions of its products worldwide, just 2 weeks after a similar recall of toys in its Fisher-Price unit. Safety concerns have been raised over the use of lead paint in some of the toys and small, powerful magnets in others. All of the products in question were manufactured in China. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
We now turn our attention to the continuing conflict in the East African nation of Somalia. A new report from the group Human Rights Watch claims that Ethiopian, Somali, and rebel forces are all responsible for violating international rules for war that is causing mass suffering for the civilian population. The report is being billed as the first independent investigation of the fighting that racked Mogadishu in March and April of this year, resulting in the deaths of hundreds of civilians and the displacement of 400,000 people. It comes as the United Nations Security Council is due to discuss the 1,500-member African Union mission in Somalia and proposals to turn the mission into a UN force. To talk about the report, we're joined by Steve Crawshaw, who is based in Human Rights Watch's New York office. Steve Crawshaw, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, the report does accuse all sides in the Somalian conflict of abuse, but let's first begin with Somalia's neighboring country of Ethiopia, who helped drive the Islamic courts from power earlier this year.
Yes, as you say, it is all sides, though. We have both the insurgents and the Somali transitional government, but also the Ethiopian government forces. And I think it's interesting to note how little pressure, how extraordinary little criticism there has been of their behavior, whose outline was already documented. The report that we produced has it in much greater detail, that basically they have been shelling areas, civilian neighborhoods, where they have literally gone from neighborhood to neighborhood, basically flattening those areas in the full knowledge that civilians were living there. This is, of course, absolutely against all the, you know, it is utterly illegal to fight in that way if you know that civilians will be the main people who will be affected. They were also, for example, targeting two of the main hospitals in Mogadishu. Again, absolutely illegal against all the rules of war. It's as though they feel that because they're not under scrutiny, anything can happen and it doesn't really matter. And I think that finally needs to change.
Now, it's believed by many that the U.S. has supported Ethiopia in its activity in Somalia, as well as the interim government. Should there be any attention paid to the United States over that?
I think absolutely. I think there is a very strong sense that Ethiopia feels that it's basically untouchable. It's interesting, in response to our report, the Ethiopian government immediately came out and said that it was a quote-unquote fabrication, and that the whole thing was just made up from beginning to end. And they can rely on, I think, frankly, most objective readers would expect it more likely that Human Rights Watch had taken care over their facts than the Ethiopian government. But it's interesting that from the U.S. administration, we don't really hear words of criticism of Ethiopia. They frame it, as so often happens, as the ally in the war on terror. And as we all know, allies in the war on terror, again and again, are seen as somehow above criticism. In fact, of course, what the Ethiopian actions, in general, the actions by all the parties there, but what the Ethiopian actions is doing, of course, is to increase the sense of instability, anarchy and instability, rather than helping. I mean, you cannot go around unpunished killing civilians and feel that that's the way to forward towards a stable Somalia. It clearly is not.
Now, your report has been rejected by all the warring factions in Somalia. The Ethiopian Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Wahid Bilal, denounced the report, saying that it was biased with the insurgents. He said that the report offended the extremists.
Well, of course, it's ironic, isn't it? It's supposed to be biased against, as you yourself say, the insurgents have also criticized. I think it's interesting, these spokesmen who probably rely on the reader actually not, in fact, reading the report. Of course, we are critical of very severe abuses committed by the insurgents, which includes the fact of them placing weapons deliberately in civilian areas and then running away and then moving away once the attack back from the Ethiopians came. But the fact is that we have seen that the Ethiopian abuses were very serious. I say, just to take one example, the targeting of the hospital, that was deliberately done. There's no question at all. And I think that the Ethiopians do themselves no favors by coming out with a mendacious denial. I mean, it simply lies, frankly, to deny what's been happening. I think they would be better advised to address the problems and to move forward on that basis.
Steve Crushaw is with the group Human Rights Watch. He joined us to talk about a new report outlining abuses in Somalia's ongoing conflict. Steve Crushaw, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And just last weekend in Somalia, two prominent radio journalists from the station known as Horn Afrique were assassinated. Horn Afrique is known for its independence and willingness to criticize the government. Also in a separate incident, Free Speech Radio news correspondent in Somalia, Abdu Rahman Warsame, got caught between the crosshairs of gunfire, and he was shot in the leg. He is recuperating, and everyone at Free Speech Radio News wishes him the speediest of recoveries. The American Bar Association has overwhelmingly approved a resolution urging Congress to overturn President George Bush's July 20th executive order on the treatment of so-called enemy combatants. The ABA is meeting in San Francisco this week, where the country's largest lawyer association concluded that the order violates protections from torture in the Geneva Conventions. Eric Klein attended the meeting, and he files this report.
The American Bar Association passed the resolution overwhelmingly by voice vote.
The chair recognizes James Silkner.
We do not refrain from torture because we like the detainees. We avoid using torture because of what it says about us as a nation and as a society. How can there be any question about this resolution? I ask for you to support it. Thank you.
When Congress passed the Military Commissions Act in 2006, it required the president to issue an executive order that reconciled CIA interrogation techniques with Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which requires all detainees to be treated humanely. That executive order was issued by President Bush on July 20th.
6 days after the executive order was issued, a critique of that and a criticism of that executive order appeared in the Washington Post.
Albert C. Harvey is the chair of the Bar Association Standing Committee on Law and National Security. He cited the editorial written by retired Marine Commandant P.X. Kelly and a former chair of the ABA's Law and National Security Committee, Robert Turner.
As Bob Turner and General Kelly reasoned, we cannot put our own spin or interpretation on Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. When we send our troops into harm's way, we expect a foreign power to observe the Geneva Convention in the treatment of prisoners of war. If we expect that, we can do no less.
In 2004, the ABA passed a similar resolution addressing treatment of detainees in U.S. custody, after news of secret CIA detention facilities across Europe was confirmed. Catherine Madigan is president of the New York Bar Association.
That recommendation called upon the U.S. government for the humane treatment of all foreign detainees under the control and custody of the United States. And this recent executive order confirms the enhanced interrogation techniques of the CIA, which are truly at odds with Common Article 3. The ABA cannot countenance the continued violation of international law, which has already done incalculable damage to our nation at home and abroad.
Michael Posner is with Human Rights First. He's also a member of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. Posner says that the CIA's interrogation techniques include waterboarding, where a detainee's mouth is stuffed with a wet sponge, their face covered in plastic, and water is poured over them. The process simulates drowning and induces panic so successfully that even those aware of the technical aspects of waterboarding cannot withstand the procedure. Posner says the CIA interrogation techniques also include extreme sensory deprivation, sleep deprivation, stress positions, and mock executions. He adds that these techniques run counter to the new 2006 Army Field Manual, written after the Supreme Court's Hamdan v. Rumsfeld decision, which ruled that all individuals in U.S. custody were protected from cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment under the Geneva Conventions.
You have many situations, a number of situations, where you have joint interrogations, where you have somebody from one of the intelligence services and the Army in the same room interrogating the same people. And one of the concerns that we've heard expressed repeatedly from people in the military is that if you have different standards, the lower standard's going to win, prevail. So there's a great anxiety. The Army has written a field manual on interrogations, which complies with Common Article 3, which complies with the law. They're nervous that the CIA is going to come in and dilute that and put their soldiers at risk.
The ABA, as well as some senior retired Army personnel, have recently stated that strict adherence to Common Article 3 by the United States protects U.S. military personnel who are captured by the other side. Posner says he thinks the Congress will, in a matter of months, take up the President's July 20th executive order that allows the CIA to torture detainees, and that the ABA's resolution urging Congress to supersede that order is a strong step in the right direction.
The executive order violates the law, it violates the treaty obligation, and Congress has to take action to overturn it.
From San Francisco, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
A new study suggests that half of all low-income people who go to bed hungry in the United States do not receive food stamps. So our correspondent Leanne Caldwell went out to take this look at the food stamp program.
To be eligible for the food stamp program, a household of three must earn less than $19,800 per year. And for 25 million Americans, food stamps put meals on the table. But there's another 25 million people who don't receive them and need them, according to a new study released by the National Priorities Project.
Why is that? Is there a problem with the eligibility criteria in the food stamp program that so many low-income people are still going without? Are there problems in the procedure and process and barriers and application? Is it onerous? Is it not worth it because the benefit level is so low? Is there a stigma that we're still needing to struggle in our society so that people feel comfortable getting help when they need it?
Pamela Schwartz, Communications Director for the National Priorities Project, doesn't have the answers but comes to this conclusion.
It's very safe to say that there are a lot of people out there right now who are low income who are not getting the benefits that they need to go without food insecurity.
The study also found that southern rural areas had the highest participation. Furthermore, in every part of the country except for the Midwest, food stamps are more prevalent among rural residents compared to urban dwellers. And the National Priorities Project is not the only group to come to that conclusion. Kristen Smith, co-author of a University of New Hampshire Carsey Institute study, found the same thing about rural residents.
As they are more likely to live in poverty, and they also are more likely to live in a food insecure household, which means that at some point during the year, they did not have access to enough food for all household members. But also, some research shows that rural residents are more likely to use the food stamp program.
Many people are also being squeezed from the program because of draconian eligibility requirements. For example, immigrants are not eligible for 5 years. Neither are people who have $2,000 in assets, including a retirement savings account. But some issues have been addressed in the Farm Bill the House of Representatives passed in July. Jennifer Attic is with the Food Action Research Center.
The reauthorization of the Farm Bill are really representing real progress towards addressing hunger in the United States, and we're just really hoping that we can, these changes have made a great investment, but we're hoping that we can strengthen the nutrition title even more as we move forward with the process.
The Farm Bill added $4 billion to expand nutrition programs, including food stamps. Participants would be able to have $3,000 in savings. Retirement and education accounts would not be disqualifiers. Families with children will receive more, and the monthly allotment of $21 per person will be increased. But controversy rose on how to pay for those programs. Democratic leaders in the House decided it would come from taxes placed on U.S. businesses that offshore their headquarters. Many Republicans were opposed. But the Farm Bill must still go through the Senate. A plan to expand nutrition programs is popular, but no agreement has been reached on how to pay for it. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As we reported yesterday, hundreds of activists were on their way to occupy an Oregon beach so to stop the development of a natural gas facility. Jenka Soderberg has the latest details.
A flotilla of boats from Puget Island landed late yesterday on the beach at Bradwood, Oregon, where Northern Star Natural Gas is seeking permits to develop an LNG import terminal. The No LNG Armada is trying to highlight the extreme proximity of the liquefied natural gas or LNG proposal to residents of Puget Island. The project is one of four being considered in Oregon. None have yet been approved. Recent photographs produced by Northern Star show every house within 2 miles of the Bradwood proposal with a number on its roof. The images correspond roughly to the potential fire hazard and vapor cloud dispersion area in the case of a large LNG spill. George Exum lives within a mile of the proposed site.
It would probably totally destroy the quality of life as most people know it here now. There would be 24/7 noise and light, especially during the 3 years of construction. And then basically the militarization of the river, any transit of an LNG tanker up and down the river is escorted by Coast Guard gunboats, helicopters, and three tugboats. The economics and the need factor aren't being addressed.
A study by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission concluded that in some scenarios, a leak of liquefied natural gas could create a flammable, toxic vapor cloud that might travel several thousand feet before dissipating. Northern Star and other companies submitting proposals have not addressed the potential for spills or the fact that the terminal would be built at the mouth of the Columbia River, a major water source for the region. Activists have worked with scientific data to determine that the amount of natural gas being imported by the terminal would far exceed the projected natural gas usage for the state of Oregon, leading them to conclude that 90% of the gas would be piped to the California market. The company doesn't deny this claim, saying only that the gas will remain in the Pacific Northwest. Joe Desmond with Northern Star.
We have focused Bradwood Landing for the Pacific Northwest market. When we say the Pacific Northwest, we are referring to Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and British Columbia. That is generally defined as the Pacific Northwest market. So I can't tell you who will have contracts, but it will be targeted, and our expectation is that it is folks within the Pacific Northwest region.
Monica Vaughn is with the Convergence for Climate Action.
The first step to responding to climate change needs to be halting any new development for fossil fuel infrastructure. Liquefied natural gas is a dirty, dirty energy, no matter what the industry says. They're trying to pass it off as a clean energy, but it's a lot different than natural gas because of the life cycle emissions that it takes with extraction, transporting it here, liquefying it. You have to freeze it to 260 degrees below Fahrenheit to liquefy it in order to transport it around the world. That takes a lot of energy. So when you look at all the greenhouse gas emissions that come from the life cycle of liquefied natural gas, you find that it's actually just as dirty as coal. So we really, really want to drill that into people because the industry is just lying to everybody saying that it's a clean fuel.
Participants occupied the site through the night and traveled to Portland today to protest in the city's downtown. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jenka Soderberg reporting from Skamokawa, Washington.
A majority of West Papuans have been seeking an independent state for some time, but the 1969 Act of Free Choice Vote ensured that the ex-Dutch colony became formally part of Indonesia. A low-level war of independence was waged up until the fall of Suharto in 1998, pitching Papuans with bow and arrows against the modern Indonesian army. In 2001, Indonesia and the ruling elite in West Papua struck a compromise with Jakarta, agreeing to allow self-rule within the province under the special autonomy law. But as Erica Vowles reports, many Papuans feel that the law is failing to protect their economic well-being as well as their lives.
West Papuan man Jacobus Jiminop lies critically injured in hospital after reportedly being beaten and tortured by the Indonesian military. Special autonomy was supposed to stop human rights abuses and lead to a reduction in Indonesian troop levels in West Papua. But Agus Alu Alua, chairman of the Papuan People's Assembly, says they have been doubled.
Human rights violation in West Papua is part of military pressure. Never the outside of this. And during a special autonomy law, the military institutions increased and troops more and more. That means military human rights violation also more increased.
Reports of human rights abuses have effectively been ignored by Indonesian government officials, despite Jakarta's 2001 promise to set up a commission to investigate abuse cases. Bertie Harwan, director of the Catholic Office for Justice and Peace in the West Papuan capital of Jayapura, says many people continue to live in fear because brutality at the hands of the Indonesian military continues unchecked.
What we find is they normally use torture. One or two villages, but they do it in public. So basically, you could control the whole community by doing that kind of torture and that kind of practice in public.
Special autonomy was also supposed to see increased revenues flow through to ordinary people in the form of improved health and education services. This hasn't happened, and for this, people blame both corruption at a local Papuan level and failure to fully implement the law in central Jakarta. Speaking for the Indonesian government, spokesperson Dino Kusnadi said autonomy remains the only practical solution.
My argument is that on the table you have special autonomy, a wide-ranging autonomy. It's on the table. The best way for that in front of you is to make that work. We've seen today that there's a lot of incompetence within the local government or even the central government. But again, out of these incompetence, at least there should be an enlightenment process on how to get that job done.
Franz Albert Joku is a member of the Papuan Presidium Council, which was formed in 1999 to call for independence. Unlike his fellow council members, he believes that despite problems with the implementation, special autonomy remains the only path to empowerment for Papuans.
Papuans should have every reason to now, I believe, firmly embrace the special autonomy laws, however diluted, imperfect, or incomplete they may be in the present form. Realistically, there is no other option on the table right now that we can legitimately discuss and pursue it as an achievable goal.
However, Budi Harwan says many ordinary people in West Papua have seen no benefits in their autonomous status.
I think many Papuans still want independence. They do. And I believe it's an expression of desperate situation. They don't see the concrete progress of their welfare. They don't see that their fundamental freedoms and fundamental rights are respected, protected. So basically they have nothing to lose in this support for our independence.
However, the lack of international support for separation makes independence very unlikely in the near future. Despite this, in an ominous echo of events in East Timor in 1999, they say the Indonesian military is encouraging the creation of pro-Indonesian militia groups as an extra form of insurance against an independent West Papua. This is Erica Voles in Sydney reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Monica Lopez and Tana Geise. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical team is Puck Lowe and Antonio Ortiz. If you'd like to listen to this or any other Free Speech Radio News broadcast, you can check us out online at www.fsrn.org. Again, that's www.fsrn.org. Filling in for Ada Bogado, I'm Mitch Jezerich in New York.